Hi and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force across three different force areas, and we've discussed a lot of those so far. This is episode 70, so we're getting on into it. If this is your first time, welcome. You might want to go back to the beginning possibly, but entirely up to you. And if you've been here before, then welcome back and hope you're enjoying it. Thanks for the downloads this week. Been very good again, and more coffee's bought for me, so I appreciate it. Got some comments again on YouTube. Don't forget you can go onto YouTube to make comments, good or bad, and generally abuse me if you want to. That's not a problem. And also, if there's any questions, if you had anything in particular that you wanted to ask, I'll try and answer them in the future episodes. So this week we're going to speak about... I was still on the dive team, but before we start that, we're just going to cover a couple of little things, and one particular is in the news now. The advantage of not being in the police anymore and being retired is I can actually have an opinion on things and make comments. You know, the frustrating thing when you're in the police is if anything controversial is going on, then generally, you know, you're not allowed to have an opinion, particularly when you're at work. You just don't discuss things about anything controversial, you know. You have to keep your thoughts to yourself, and that's particularly frustrating and difficult when you're in at things like policing protests. You know, you might have very strong views on whatever the protest is about, good or bad, for or against, you know, but unfortunately you're not allowed to show that, and regardless, you know, you don't let it affect your sort of decision making process and how you deal with the people there. But now that I'm retired, I can have an opinion. And the one thing I wanted to talk about today briefly was the Chris Cabba trial, which has just finished yesterday as I talked to you. Now, some of you obviously won't have heard of this, particularly from other countries other than the UK. But Chris Cabba was a 24-year-old male from London. And it's probably a couple of years ago now, he was shot dead by armed police during a traffic stop. There's a bit more to it than that, which we'll get into in a minute. But the trial ended yesterday. The officer who shot him was actually on trial for murder. You can imagine there's been a lot of sort of controversial stuff come out around that. And quite often, a lot of it absolutely ridiculous from people that have no clue how these things work, the law, you know, or have never sort of been in that position or, you know, being a police officer, let alone a firearms officer, and realise the sort of challenges you face. Now, obviously, I was a firearms officer, so I am a bit biased for sure. But, you know, people are completely unrealistic in what they think, you know, armed police do or can do or should achieve, you know. So I just wanted to briefly discuss it. And what happened was this car that Chris Cabba was driving was involved in a shooting incident the previous night, and presumably they then put a marker on the Police National Computer, the PNC, to say that that vehicle should be stopped, you know, and the details obtained of the driver, because obviously, you know, if you stopped it a week later, it may be, you know, somebody who has nothing to do with that shooting. But certainly that vehicle was linked to a shooting. So police went to stop it, and it was armed police that stopped it, because obviously there is a potential firearms threat from that vehicle, you know, and they would have known this when they stopped it. Now, it was at night, it was dark, so I'd be amazed if they could actually see who was in the vehicle initially, because straight away people have jumped on a bandwagon, you know, well, he was only stopped because of the colour of his skin, he was a black male, you know. But so the reality is, stopping a vehicle at night, until you actually stop it, it's unlikely that you're going to know who's in that vehicle. So they're just stopping the vehicle, I suspect, certainly initially anyway. So this vehicle was followed, and I think in the end, at least two ARVs, armed response vehicles, stopped it. One was marked, i.e., you know, with police stripes, as an obvious police car, and the other one was unmarked. And they instigated what's called a hard stop, you know, a vehicle strike, which is by its very nature, you know, designed to be aggressive and fast moving, because, you know, you don't do it to stop somebody to tell them, you know, they've got a brake light out. You do it, you know, when you've got, you know, potentially violent or armed suspects, or in this case, a vehicle, you know, that's linked to a shooting. So you don't tend to sort of muck around with those sorts of people for obvious reasons. So they tried to stop the vehicle, and I think they boxed it in. I've seen the body cam footage. It's out there on the internet. By all means, have a look. And you'll see that they tried to box the vehicle, a police car in front, police car behind. And basically, you know, the officers are out of the vehicle shouting, pointing guns. You know, certainly his vehicle windows get smashed. But before that happens, he tries to ram his way out of the box that's on, you know, that's trying to prevent his vehicle from moving. So he basically reverses into the police car behind him. He drives forward and crashes into another vehicle beside him. I'm not sure if that's a member of the public's car or a police vehicle, but certainly the officers are now swarming around him. And you can hear in the background, there's a lot of revving of engines and, you know, and wheels spinning. And that was the evidence that was given by the officer as well. And the officer found himself standing towards the front of the vehicle, not directly in front of it, because, you know, you're asking to be run over. But he, you know, gave his evidence that he was genuinely in fear of his life and that, and his colleagues' lives. You know, this guy was using his vehicle as a weapon, and lots have been made in the press and on Twitter and all the rest of it about the fact that this was an unarmed male, you know, and the police murdered him for no reason. I mean, it's absolute rubbish. These people talk about this stuff and just, you know, conveniently miss out all the background and everything that sort of goes along with it. The officer who was in front of Chris Cabber fired a single shot, which hit him in the head and killed him instantly. And hence the murder trial. He's just been found not guilty, the officer. And if you look at the background, now obviously the officer wouldn't have known the background of the male in the vehicle. He's going on, you know, that vehicle and the history of that vehicle. And if that vehicle had just stopped, you know, and stayed still, I very much doubt there would have been a problem. But as I say, if you see the body cam footage, I think it'll become quite apparent how it ended, how it did, or at least most reasonable people can see that. And now we know the background of Chris Cabber. Previously convicted when he was 19, some 5 years before, for possession of a firearm. He was in a well-known gang. He'd been certainly arrested and I think charged of possession of a knife. His gang was well known for carrying out murders, and a number of the members of that gang were already in prison for murders. They were very much into this sort of rapping, singing scene where they kind of glamorize gang life and murders and all this background and history. And yet you still have people, you know, saying that he was a really nice guy and he wouldn't have hurt a fly. You know, well, I'm sorry, but the evidence just doesn't support that. You know, that's the total opposite to what the evidence suggests. But anyway, get my little rant out of the way. And that's that. But you have to understand, I've said this before, as a police officer, you know, you can do no right. There'll always be someone to criticize you. Even when something seems very, very straightforward, there'll be somebody who, you know, sort of put in their two pence worth about how you did it wrong, why you shouldn't have done it like that, and various reasons. And you just have to accept it as a police officer, you know. And of course, people have always got an agenda to have a go at the police. So there we go. Anyway, we're going to talk about a couple of little bits today. We're brushing up on just a few of the last incidents that I dealt with before I left the Met prior to transferring to another force, which we're very close to now. And the first one I want to talk about is I was still on the dive team. There was information, I'm going to be deliberately vague around this, there was information about a missing person from some years before in London. They believe that person had been murdered, but they'd never found their body. They'd just disappeared. But there was a lot of evidence to suggest that that person had been murdered. And again, the detectives had some suspects, but had never been able to prove anything or charge anyone. As the years went by, you know, they really wanted to try and obviously solve this missing case stroke murder, which they were saying they're pretty convinced that it was. So the plan that they came up with, which we assisted them with, was the main suspects still live together, and they actually got authority to bug their house so that they could, you know, use listening devices within the house to hear what they were saying. And then the idea was that a local pond, local to them, would be searched by us, the dive team, for the body. And a very big thing was made of it. It was all in the press. And we had senior officers down beside the pond. We had film crews there from the news filming. We actually had a documentary series that was doing something on the Met at the time. I think it was called The Job or something like that. Came along as well with us for the day, and I did an interview to them, and we told anyone that would listen, basically, we were searching for a body, and we were searching for this particular person in this pond. You know, we believe that they were in this location, and there was posters up everywhere. You know, it was a big deal. And we carried out a normal ARC search within this pond while all the camera crews waited. Now, the thing is, camera crews, you know, filming diving, it's all very exciting when you see the diver getting kitted up and eventually going in the water. But the reality is, once they're in the water, you just see bubbles on the surface. It doesn't make for good telly, to be honest with you. So normally, you know, if there's anything on sort of police diving on the TV, you get, you know, kind of 30 seconds of bubbles in the water, and then you see them getting kitted up and you see them, you know, finding things and all the rest of it. But the actual diving itself, which can go on for hours, which is the main bit of it, is pretty boring. So I don't think you get a lot of TV coverage as a police diver, that's for sure. So this dive was set up, and what they'd done was, as I said, they'd actually bugged the home address of these two suspects. And the hope was that because we'd made such a big deal in the press about, you know, the fact that we were looking for this person, that they were going to start to have a discussion and maybe say, you know, "Oh, stupid cops, you know, they're searching in so-and-so pond, they're never going to find him because, you know, he's in such and such," or, you know, do you know what I mean? They were going to hopefully give some clue as to, firstly, what had happened to the person, and also where he may be. So the sort of whole pond search was completely made up. It was a complete ruse by us to try and instigate this happening. Unfortunately, it didn't work. I don't know the full details of what was said when they listened in to the sort of recordings from the address, but I do know that's a very high level authority to actually get that. And can you imagine, you know, that there are cops out there, super sneaky cops, I might add, that have to physically, you know, sort of break into locations to plant these bugs. There's various ways they go about that. But, you know, a very high level of authority. They obviously thought they were going to get somewhere, but as I say, unfortunately, it didn't work. So we carried out this search for the day. From memory, we actually found, I think, some knives and a handgun, which the press thought was very exciting, but, you know, absolutely nothing to do. It was just a random pond that we picked to what for us was effectively a training dive. Although I would have been really surprised if we'd have found a body as well, unexpectedly. But, yeah, all a ruse and didn't work, unfortunately. So that was one thing we carried out. Now, we talked before as well about, obviously, body recovery many times on the dive team. And I've also said, and again, some people might not be too sure on this, but, you know, finding your first body as a police diver is very much a rite of passage. And, you know, for sure, as a new diver, it's something you kind of want to get under your belt. You'll feel like, you know, a proper diver then, and that you're sort of part of the gang. And perhaps stupidly, you know, you also get a certain type of hat that has a diver symbol on it. And everyone within the team knows that now that person, you know, has found their first body in it, and it kind of a bit more accepted. And certainly from a professional point of view, you know, you want that is the sort of ultimate thing to do, search for a body, you know, that you believe in some water and actually locate them. Now, we've talked before that there is this, you know, kind of round robin of divers. We all had a number and you dived in strict number order. So it was a total fluke, really, whether you actually got to find a body as such. You know, if you were going on a job where we believe there was a body, if you were the first diver, you might have a chance of finding it. But again, as we discussed before, probably if you were the second or third diver that day, you were more likely to find it, because we would always put an overlap in, you know, so you'd start, you know, 10, 20 meters before where we thought it was, and then you'd search through the area where you believe the body was and then continue on the outside. And it could just be a total sort of luck, if that's what you'd call it, whether you were the one that actually found the body or not. So some people that came on the dive team within, you know, a month had their first body. Other people, and I'm thinking of a colleague in particular, he spent about 3 years on the team and never actually found a body. And it wasn't because of his lack of skill, although obviously we wound him up about that, but it was just purely how it had worked out. You know, now I think he'd assisted on some where other divers had found bodies, and then I think we've said that the second diver goes in to assist with the actual retrieval of that body. He certainly had opportunities and be involved in it. You know, we'd done loads of training dives and there was absolutely no problems at all. But it just always worked out that whenever we were doing a search and that, you know, a diver was likely to find the body, it was never him. You know, he was either the attendant or he'd been the first diver or he was the last diver, you know, or he was the standby. So he went in and helped. And over time, you know, he laughed it off, but we always wound him up about it and said, you know, well, I just don't think you can be a very good diver. You know, I mean, everyone else has found one. It's just you, I think. You know, and of course, we would obviously build it up and wind him up about it. And he had a good sense of humour, so he took it as it was meant most of the time, I think. But then finally, his day came. And as I say, I think he'd been on the team about 3 years, and we had information that there was a body to be recovered from a canal. And he was the next diver. And also, apparently, now he hadn't been there, obviously, so we were told the information was very solid as to where the body was. So rather than kind of putting in this big overlap of, you know, 20 meters or whatever, and that this particular colleague was going to be second or third diver and therefore miss his opportunity, we were thinking the first diver would probably find this one. So the story goes, and it's a little bit of a strange one, but this is, you know, how people react. So it was three heroin addicts, and they were shooting up, they were injecting heroin, as they do. And I'm not sure what went wrong, whether, you know, the dose was too high, whether they put too much in or what happened. But one of the three died during the process of taking heroin, which, you know, unfortunately, you know, happens regularly. We see sort of intravenous drug users die a lot from this sort of thing. Now, at this point, had the other two drug users just picked up the phone 999 and said to the ambulance, the police, you know, fire, whoever, but probably the ambulance, my friend's collapsed, you know, that's all they had to say. They didn't have to even be there. They could have been anonymous and just said, my friend's collapsed in his house, and then left and let the ambulance find him. You know, perhaps there was a chance that he could have been saved, but the reality was, I think he was well dead by, you know, they kind of got to this point. I think they'd all three of them sort of flaked out, and from memory, when they kind of came round, you know, their friend was dead. So that's all they had to do, you know, ring the ambulance. And at no point would they have got in trouble. Would they have been arrested? You know, nothing like that. It literally would have gone down as a drugs death. There'd have been a post-mortem, no doubt. But no blame would have been apportioned to either of those two, unless you could find clear evidence that, you know, they'd injected them with double the dose or whatever, unlikely as that is. So, yeah, there would have been no sort of, you know, comeback on them at all. But weirdly, at this point, they chose to try and conceal the death. And I don't really understand it, but it caused them a lot more problem, you know, than they needed to. Now, obviously, there's various ways of people, you know, concealing bodies. You know, you'll see them, you know, big holes dug in the back garden. You'll see people thrown into bins and wrapped in plastic bags. And we've seen people, you know, dismembered. And, you know, we had a job once where somebody was dismembered and various limbs were thrown out on a train journey. You know, this is when you could open the windows. In the UK, you pretty much can't open the windows of trains now. You know, they're all sealed and they're air conditioned. But when you used to be able to open windows and doors, somebody had traveled along this route and basically thrown out a body part every, you know, 10 or 15 minutes. So they'd spread this body right along the train track. So, you know, if you can think of it, it's probably happened in terms of body disposal. But what I think is probably not high on the list of kind of body disposal 101 is getting a shopping trolley from the supermarket and putting the body in that and wheeling it down the road. But this is what happened with this male. So they, first of all, and again, I can't explain this to you, they hogtied him. Now, most of you will know what I mean by hogtying. You can Google it if not. But basically, he is in a sort of kneeling, squatting position, if you like, and his arms were tied to kind of his ankles to sort of keep him. Well, I don't know why, basically, but that's what happened. And then he was placed into this shopping trolley, and I think it was a blanket or a tarpaulin or something like that was put over top of him. Now, this did happen in the early hours, in you know, 2-3 in the morning, obviously dark. But even so, you know, there was a fair bit of risk to them because, you know, that's the sort of time when you're going to stand out walking down the street anyway with a shopping trolley. But the fact that you've got a body in it, you know, some people might think, you know, that was strange. So they put a blanket or a tarpaulin over top of him and they wheeled him down to the local canal, down onto the towpath, and then they pushed the shopping trolley in. But this is where it becomes a little bit of a comedy moment. Now, perhaps people think I'm being, you know, flippant or whatever, but unfortunately, when you've dealt with this stuff and you're in this scenario, as we've discussed before, you do develop a certain morbid sense of humour. And certainly in my old role, you know, that was something you absolutely had to have. So they push the trolley in, obviously intending for the shopping trolley and the body, which was tied into the trolley, to sink, to never be seen again. They thought they were in the clear. Remember back that they were in the clear anyway, had they just picked up the phone and absolutely, you know, they had no reason to conceal this body in any way. Unfortunately, the canal was particularly low level at that point. Now, canals are only about 2 meters deep anyway, most of them. But I think, you know, there'd been a problem with the locks or something. So the water level was down in the canal, and I think it was only about a meter deep or something. So yes, in a slight comedy moment, they push this trolley in with the body concealed into it, imagining it's going to sink into the depths, to find that actually when it's in the canal, the top half of the shopping trolley, and I think it was the elbow and the hand, which had now become sort of detached from where they tied it to the ankle of this poor guy, was sticking out at the top of the water for all to see, you know. So anyway, these two guys kind of made good their escape, and this is where we come in. So we turn up at this scene, and this slightly bizarre scene where there's a crowd there, and, you know, normally we try and be subtle and we would try and hide what we were doing, and like I say, we, you know, bodies get bagged up under the water so that people just see you know, a body bag coming out and not an actual body. But there was no hiding it, do you know what I mean? This guy was in the trolley and was clearly sticking out. So imagine my colleague now, who is pretty keen to sort of find his first body and finally become a complete, you know, police diver who's carried out all the roles. And when we turn up and he's actually sticking out. So, of course, we were now ribbing him and saying, well, there's no searching required. You know, we can see him from the bank. It's not like you have to look for him. You're just going to swim straight to him and we'll recover him. Of course, he was very much a no, this is my body. I'll be recovering this body. I'll be finding this body. And of course, we were winding him up. No, that's not the case. You know, you haven't got, this one doesn't count. You know, you haven't got to find him. We can all see him. There's no finding involved or searching. So this one doesn't count. So poor guy. Yeah, he didn't get over that at the time. And that's what we did, unfortunately. You know, he got in, the diver, and of course went over, attached a line to the trolley, and then we pulled the trolley from the shore, you know, as he sort of pushed from the other side, and eventually we got the trolley back and recovered the body in the trolley. But yeah, we never let him forget that one, and said that absolutely it didn't count, because that's, you know, that's what we did. That's what you do in that scenario. And the two guys, they figured out who they were eventually. I think there was various sort of DNA evidence. They both ultimately got convicted for, I think it's something like, it's quite a bit of an obscure one. It's something like failing to carry out a proper burial or something like that. There's some slightly obscure law. So the two guys actually got convicted of this, when, bearing in mind, they would have had no problems at all and not got in trouble anyway. So, yeah, a bit of a strange one, to say the least. But, you know, much as you'll think it probably shouldn't, it did give us a few chuckles because of the wind-up on our colleague. So on to the next one. We were called, I'm just sort of putting in a few here, as you can hear, but another fairly quick one. We were called up to a North London cemetery, and you'd expect holes to be dug in the cemetery, but there'd been a hole found there, and it was quite a big one. It was about 5 feet deep. Certainly, I sort of searched it. I say the word loosely, but when I got in, it was kind of up to my chest, maybe my shoulders high, and about 15 foot long, something like that. It had, and about maybe 4 foot wide, so quite a substantial hole, you know, much bigger than a normal grave. It was about, you know, like sort of 10 graves all piled together. It had, the groundsman had actually found it, but it had plywood sheets across the top of it, and then plastic on top of that, and then there'd been a lot of sort of foliage and leaves and things put on it. It was also pretty wet and muddy inside, you know, there was no drainage or anything, so it leaked quite a bit, and they were a bit, you know, concerned about what this was. Well, there was some forensic work carried out, and actually what it was discovered to be was an IRA weapons cache, formerly, back in the Troubles, you know, in kind of like 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Obviously, the UK had a big problem with the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, and there was various sort of terrorist attacks on the UK, particularly in and around London. Now, what happens with terrorist types is if they have weapons caches, they tend to have, you know, like a central area where they'll keep explosives and firearms. But then they'll have a lot smaller, they call them hides, dotted all around the place. And they're very careful on who knows the location of those. And certainly when they do that, it's not like some big chief somewhere knows where all these hides are. They're very careful that the location of them is only known to maybe one person. So, for example, a weapon or explosives would be handed by the quartermaster, as they would call them, which was the person who was, you know, sort of looking after the big cache of weapons. They would hand this firearm, let's say, to one of their people, who would then go and hand that to someone else. And it might go through three or four different people, but just individuals, before it ends up with this one person who is expected to put it in their local hide to them. And then should word come through that that firearm was used or needed for an attack, word would be sent to them, and then just that one person, the only person who knew about it, would go to their individual hide to recover the weapon, to then pass it back up the chain to actually be used in the attack. And certainly London had a number of these weapons hides, you know, dotted around the capital, and this one had never been found. And by the time we found it, it would have been, you know, kind of 2016 or something like that. So the peace process had happened, you know, Ireland was no longer an issue, and this was a disused weapon cache. But certainly I think forensically it was proved that that's what it had been used for at one time or another. So a quick job, but quite an interesting one again. And we were called in because it was wet and also a kind of confined space type search, so that was quite interesting. And I'll just finish up with just one, what I think is a funny story. You may or may not agree with me. And I'm going to start throwing a few of these in. You know, I've told you a lot of my incidents and my stories. But obviously, throughout my service, I hear various other stories and funny incidents. So I will start putting in a few of these as well. But I'll make it clear that they're not necessarily mine. So a friend of mine went on to his 3-week advanced motorcyclist course. He wanted to be a traffic officer, and he'd done his advanced car course, which is, depending on the force, sort of 2 to 4 weeks long, very intensive driving. At the end of it, you'll come out, you know, a fantastic police driver. The next stage of that, if you're interested in motorbikes, is you can also go on to do the motorcycle course. And my friend had gone on to do his advanced motorcycle course. And what happens is, you know, initially the instructors ride around behind you, and then they'll get you to follow them, and they sort of demonstrate some of the stuff they're looking at, and the positions and the speed and the overtakes and what have you. And slowly, as the sort of, you know, 3 to 4 weeks goes on, your skills develop, things get quicker, you know, the instructor will tuck in behind you and watch you. And then it culminates in normally 2 or 3 days before the end of the course, there'll be a final drive where you'll have an instructor, or, you know, maybe like the chief examiner or something of advanced driving in that particular force, will come out and you'll do a check drive with them following you. And you need to come up to that advanced level, which is incredibly high for motorcyclists or cars. You know, the particularly the advanced police motorcyclists, you know, their skill levels are off the charts. I love riding bikes, but not the speeds they do. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. It would terrify me, quite frankly. But But my colleague had built up to this point, and as far as he was aware, you know, the course was going pretty well. He'd been told he was on for passing his advance, you know, as long as he sort of continued to develop. And he said on his final ride, you know, they said to him, right, you know, this is it. This is where it comes all together. Don't do anything silly. And, you know, but go like, you know, bat out of hell, but in a controlled manner, you know, which is very much what they push. So he had this final drive, and the examiner was tucked in behind him, and he was just told, right, I want you to go take this route, go from here to here. There was comms between them, so every now and then the examiner would say, okay, take the next left, take the second exit off this roundabout, etc. And so they're flying along, and my pal was saying he thought it was going really well. He'd made no mistakes as far as he was aware, only a couple of little ones, nothing to worry about. He was coming to the end of the ride, and he really was feeling confident and like he'd cracked it. And also he felt that the examiner perhaps was struggling to keep up with him a bit. You know, he was a little bit cocky, my pal, and he thought that for sure, you know, he was showing this examiner a thing or two. Well, it turns out it perhaps wasn't quite the case, because he said we came to one of the final bends on the course, and he said he was absolutely on the limit. He was flat out round this corner. It was a long sweeping bend, and he was doing something like 120 miles an hour around this bend. And he said, I really felt like I was some sort of, you know, motorcycle sort of racing hero. He said he was lent right across. I mean, his knee wasn't quite down, because they don't do that in police motorcycling, but certainly, you know, he was over at quite a steep angle. He was really pushing it at, say, high speed, 120 mile an hour. And he looked in his mirror, glanced in his mirror for a split second in the middle of the bend, and he thought, I can't see the examiner in my mirror, you know. And up until then, the guy had been tucked in behind him, so he was feeling really confident, and that's it, I've lost him, I'm so good, I've lost the examiner. So he said he's got to look back ahead of him and carried on concentrating where he was going, and something caught his eye just off to the sort of right on the inside of this bend, and he looked across to see the examiner up the inside of him, right alongside of him, and he had a packet of sweets. And he had his arm extended, and he was offering my pal a sweet from this packet of sweets in the middle of this bend at 120 mile an hour, you know, absolutely hammering along. Just when my pal thought he'd lost him, you know, because he was doing so well and he was such a good rider, you know, this examiner obviously decided to show him, well, yeah, you might be good, but I'll show you what good is. It did make me chuckle that I can't imagine, you know, mid-bend at this high speed to find the examiner, you know, lent his bike right over and offering, oh, do you want a sweet, mate? You know, sort of mid-bend when he was, you know, sort of pulling out all the stops, or so he thought. But yeah, it did make me chuckle, that one, and hopefully you too. Okay, that's it then for this week. We'll continue on next week. Hope you enjoyed it, and thanks for listening. Take it easy. Cheers, bye.